All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Now, time to switch our focus more big picture. What's going on in the economy? What's going on with central banks? And what's going on in the currency markets? There's a lot that went on this week, so that's why I wanted to focus the second half of this show more big picture, trying to get a lay of the land of what's coming, hopefully for the rest of this year, if we can even predict that far out. We're chatting with Mark Chandler. Mark is a managing partner at Bannockburn Global Forex, also editor of the Mark to Market website. Now, Mark, let's start with central banks, because we had the Fed meeting this week. We also had a lot of other central banks over the last couple weeks. But first and foremost, the Fed meeting, the Fed didn't do anything. They're actually saying that they're not going to be hiking rates all this year now. But the one thing that stood out to everybody was when all the voters, the Fed heads, got to vote, there were four dissents. Some wanted rate hikes, one wanted rate cuts. Take us through what you took away from that Fed meeting, Mark.
Sure. So just to be clear about what the votes were, there were four dissents. One of them, Stephen Moran, who has been the big dove, of course, dissented in favor of a 25 basis point cut. The other three dissents, and I think this is where the surprise comes from, the other three dissents weren't so much about the decision not to change rates. Their dissents were really about the statement itself. And the Fed's code words, the way it communicates to the market, was clear that the Fed had an easing bias. Those three dissenters wanted a more neutral statement. Now, many people thought that it's an insult to Chairman Powell, who it was his last press conference, his last meeting as chair. On the other hand, other people, including myself, thought it was really a warning to the administration and to the incoming chair, Warsh, that there's not really a majority that favors a rate cut, which the administration would like to see. However, as I thought more about what happened, and I listened to Powell's comments at the press conference, it occurs to me that the dissents weren't over substantive issues. It was really a procedural disagreement. Here's the disagreement. The statement with an easing bias, the question, the procedure is, when should we best change the statement to reflect that more neutral sense that it seems like a majority of Fed officials agree with? And I think that the debate was, as far as I can tell, was over whether to change it at this week's meeting or to wait until June at the next meeting, when there's going to be a new summary of economic projections, a new dot plot. The danger, it seems, and Powell, I think, hinted at this, is to change it this past week would have meant possibly having to change it again in June. And so I think it's one of those issues that reasonable people can differ on. When's the best way to communicate this change to a more neutral tone for the FOMC? I don't think that there's anything much bigger than that. I don't think that the Federal Reserve is on the verge of hiking rates. In fact, this past week, as you mentioned, there were several other central banks that met, and I think that everybody delivered a hawkish hold. They kept policy unchanged, but seemed to warn of upside risk to inflation, and really the risk is this, what they call the secondary impact. So it's not just food and energy prices, but it's how those prices could filter into the general price level. And so all the central banks that met them, the five of the G10 met, and they all basically had this hawkish hold. I would say that even now, as we head into the weekend and a week ahead of the next jobs report, the market still has, and by market, I mean the derivatives market, like the swaps market or like the Fed funds futures, are still pricing in a small chance of a Fed cut this year, while the other central banks are anticipated to hike rates at least once.
Well, Mark, just to that point, when you think about the winds of change over the last, let's say, 2 years, it went from the expectations and the Fed funds futures pricing in 6 to 7 cuts at one point. You have President Trump railing and pounding on the table asking for cuts and picking on Powell all year. Nate's putting in Warsh as guys coming in. But it seems like the consensus globally is that hawkish hold. It seems like the nuance and getting stuck in the weeds on how they positioned the messaging in the market was really because they had a dovish hold instead of a hawkish hold, and other people wanted them to be more hawkish. What does that mean for the world if the central banks are considering being more hawkish and they are leaning more towards rate hikes than rate cuts at this point? What does that mean with the economic backdrop? How does that tie into the inflation concerns? Like you say, all the knock-on effects from what's happening in the Middle East.
Yeah, I think that, we've talked about this since the war began, really, that the supply shock really is going to deliver a 1-2 punch. The first punch is higher prices. In the US, gasoline prices are up over a third since before the war. I know I sometimes, I was joking with some clients that I feel stronger since the war began. I find I can lift over $100 worth of groceries with a single hand. Which really is a way to poke fun of the higher inflation we're seeing, that households are suffering from food prices as well as energy prices, and there's more to come. I think that pharmaceuticals, drugs, are going to be another big upward pressure on prices because of the disruption from the Middle East. But that's the first punch, is higher prices. And we haven't seen them, I mean, filter through to core levels. In fact, many of the countries that reported inflation in recent days saw actually a little bit softer core measure, excluding food and energy. But I think that other central banks are concerned about the possible secondary effects. At the same time, the second punch, which we haven't seen quite yet, at least not noticeably, partly because the war only began at the end of February. But this other punch is going to be destruction of demand. The Eurozone reported their economy grew 0.1% quarter over quarter. The market was looking for something a bit stronger. This is a sense of that Europe is more vulnerable to the supply shock than the United States. Not only are we energy self-sufficient for the most part, but we're also, I think, more flexible in dealing with these price changes than Europe. And so I think that, broadly speaking, I think that we should expect consumers, households should expect both higher prices and weaker economic growth in the coming months.
Mark, make sense of how this moves over to markets then, because look, I know we have other central banks to talk about, but I think the main issue here, the main head scratcher, is that markets are at all-time highs. We keep hearing how economic data is weak, but maybe we're not moving into that recession. However, you look at most of the earnings reports, companies are knocking it out of the park with their earnings. Estimates are much, much higher, and they're being beaten. And then a lot of the guidance we're getting is also for strong earnings. And then that ties into CapEx, which then filters into some economic data. Unfortunately, it plays so much into some of that economic data that it's just weird to hear markets at all-time highs and see earnings this high. That all makes sense together. But then hear how the economy is weak. Make sense of this.
I can tell you this, that even myself, I mean, I think maybe representative of others, I was a bit more negative on the outlook of the US economy. But as I looked at what happened last year, why I was wrong, it was because of the AI. It was a build out of the data centers, AI related demand broadly. And I think that, as I don't want to be bitten by that same dog twice, I've been watching the US economic data, and I'd say one of the most striking things is that there's been like what we call a data surprise. We all follow earnings. You're familiar with earnings surprises. Well, we do the same thing with economic data. And US economic data has generally come in above expectations. That may change, but in the recent several weeks, US data surprise to the upside. Europe, for example, has been surprising the downside. When I look at the US economy, one thing that economists sometimes do, besides looking at the headline GDP, which, as you know, the US economy grew 2%, that's at an annualized pace, which is, say, call it close to a 0.5 compared to Europe's 0.1 on a quarter over quarter basis, roughly speaking. But besides looking at that headline GDP number, what a lot of economists do, and sometimes Chairman Powell has pointed to it in his press conferences, is a measure called real final sales to private domestic purchasers. And this is really a mouthful to say. Basically, you're looking at GDP, excluding trade, inventories, and government spending. And this is supposed to give you a truer signal, a truer measure of the strength of the U.S. economy, 2.5% in Q1, on top of 1.8% in Q4 of last year. This is a fairly strong number. And on top of that, some of the data we're getting still shows a very strong tailwind coming from CapEx. The U.S. consumer is still shopping, and that's partly at the cost of dipping further into savings. That is, consumption is still outpacing income growth. And then, as you mentioned, we've had strong earnings. But I think that in some ways it still reflects what I'd say is what people have talked about as a K-shaped economy, where the winner takes all, Wall Street does well, and yet consumer sentiment is near record lows. And I think that this sort of captures this sort of awkward moment in time we're in.
Yeah, Mark, it's really a dichotomy. I was reading an article just yesterday that was saying that the number one concern from people on the street that when they've interviewed them is inflation and the cost of goods. Like you mentioned, food going up and other services going up, healthcare going up. That's their number one concern. And yet you l listen to reports on Wall Street and earnings reports, and it's like a party is happening and the companies are just blowing it out. There seems to be, like you say, that K-shape, that really that dichotomy, the two groups, the haves and the have-nots. How does that tie into that second punch, the less demand? Because if people are squeezed as consumers, not just at the gas pump, but wherever they buy anything, how does that eventually play into the economy and the markets?
Yeah, so you'd expect that the squeeze on prices cuts demand. But when you look at sort of what we call, say, durable goods, goods that you need in the house, that you, like, say, a couch or a new chair or a new kitchen table, what happens to these things? Well, when you're squeezed, you tend not to spend on durable good orders. And who's buying a lot of these durable goods for the households? The upper part of the income spectrum. And so I think we've already seen a shift in consumption. I think consumption may still hold up. Partly the I think what you're seeing is some of these tax refunds will help float the household's consumption in the next month or two. But longer term, I think that the drop in U.S. savings, any deterioration of the labor market, I think it's going to be very sensitive, and that's what's going to be the impact on consumption. But I am concerned about it in the longer term. But in the near term, I think that we should be expecting this tailwind from capital investment to still be helping to support the U.S. economy. And when everything's said and done, the labor market's still pretty firm. We're going to get the jobs report next Friday, and the early call is for about a 60,000 increase in non-farm payrolls. That's about a third of what it was in March. And remember, March is subject to downward revisions. So we need to see some sign of labor market deterioration, and right now we're not really seeing it. And I probably will take just more than just 1 month's number in next week's non-farm payroll number. We're seeing weekly jobless claims fall to new lows, and new lows for this part of the cycle. And so it does look like the U.S. economy still proving itself more resilient than many expected, including myself.
Well, and that's the whole question of this K-shaped economy, right? Is that the higher income earners, the wealthy, seem to be able to prop up the economy and sales a lot better because they seem to have money and higher gas prices don't impact them as much. And we keep seeing some pretty good numbers. Mark, what about on the political front in terms of, you mentioned tax refunds, but this big, beautiful bill. We keep hearing about just how much spending is inside of this. Is this another factor that could keep everything churning as the government keeps on spending?
Yeah, you raise a good point. I mean, when you look at what happened in Q1 GDP, government spending rose at a 4.4% annualized pace. Now, this is a huge number, to put it in perspective for you. It's the 4.4 increase is the largest since Q3 24. Yeah, I mean, and even when you exclude that, I mean, it's still the upper end of what government spending typically grows by, and the government spending typically grows by. The challenge is going to be, of course, as we get the April and May numbers the government has to pay back those tariff money that it illegally collected, according to the Supreme Court. And so that might boost government spending as well. But yeah, I think we've seen some strong government spending, and you know, the same thing we're going to see, I think, in Europe. The real emphasis now on infrastructure and military spending, and a lot of that's going to be coming from the government sector, even if it's just priming the pump for the private sector.
Yeah, it makes me think that when we look at that other metric you mentioned, the real final sales to private domestic purchasers, if you strip out the government spending, you're really stripping out a lot of the things moving the markets underneath the surface by the orders they place, whether that's a defense contract, whether that's infrastructure, whether that's construction. So it seems like it's all tying in. Do you give any thought to the real rates of growth, like when you look at GDP versus inflation, and if inflation creeps higher and GDP drops a little bit, is there a point that would concern you that the real rate, the rate between those two, the delta, has had a tipping point?
I don't know about that, Chad, because I think that when I look at the GDP numbers, like a lot of economists would, we look at it in real terms, inflation-adjusted terms. But I think what I take away from your question is really there's a debate going on. Should central banks target nominal GDP? That's growth plus inflation. And right now, of course, the central banks don't target GDP per se, but this has been often talked about as an alternative way to conduct monetary policy. And we're on the verge of some regime changes, not only in the Federal Reserve, but Lagarde only has another year or so to go as the ECB president. And so I think that in the coming year and a half or so, 2 years, we're going to see a possibility of regime changes at two of the largest central banks.
Mark, what does that look like? We talked a little bit about what the Fed could be changing, all kinds of stuff, how they target or how they view inflation, less talking by Fed presidents to the media, but what could the ECB do?
The ECB, for example, could target core inflation instead of headline inflation. They could change some of their rules to make it, to basically adopt a dual mandate like the US does. So I think that there's room for changes in these institutions. Remember what's happening too. The Eurozone has grown. You know, many people thought Greece was going to drop out many years ago. It didn't drop out, and since then, I think another couple of countries have joined. So the Eurozone is growing, and I think that there might even be a bigger push in Europe for a digital euro than in the US for a digital dollar.
Well, Mark, you're our currency guy, so I'd love to bring currencies into the equation here and look at currency pairs between Europe and the US. But also, I think it's hard to ignore the Bank of Japan this week and what's happening in Asia. So let's maybe bring Japan into the mix.
Yeah, sure. So this is one area. Sometimes people like myself, I think sometimes off by inches and sometimes by meters. And I think I was like off by meters when it came to the Bank of Japan. I did not think there was a compelling case for intervention. In 3 of the 4 weeks coming into this week, the yen had actually strengthened. So that means that there really wasn't a one-way market. Volatility was low, below the 50-day moving average for the short-dated volatility. It was actually near the year's low. So I thought that didn't justify intervention. And I thought that the market had been fairly orderly. No need for intervention for that. And then I thought there was a fundamental development, and that was that the Federal Reserve adopted this hawkish hold, and the BOJ's hawkish hold wasn't quite as compelling. It was a 6-3 vote in the Bank of Japan to keep policy on hold. The three dissents wanted to hike rates. But the governor, as he talked to the media, seemed rather so nonchalant, not strongly signaling a near-term rate hike like in June. And so for these macro reasons, I didn't expect the BOJ to intervene. And yet, as the dollar continued to climb against the yen, it got up to 160.70. And that's a new high, a new multi-year high. And that's when the BOJ intervened. And well, I should say it looks like they intervened. At first, it just looked like verbal intervention. But looking at some data from the BOJ itself, it looks as if there might have been about the equivalent of about $34.5 billion sold by the BOJ in the operation on April 30th. This is a little bit more than the average size of the operation when they last intervened back in 2024. We won't know for sure. It's still going to take a little bit of time to get the Japanese data to really determine the size of the intervention, but that's what it looks like, say, 24 hours after they intervened. Like I say, I didn't think the conditions existed for it. And I think that one of the most interesting things to me is not what happened, but what hasn't happened. Back in January, when there was verbal intervention, including by the US Treasury Secretary Bessent, remember what was happening then? The Federal Reserve, which calls around and checks on prices in the foreign exchange market on a daily basis, had checked rates in late January and said that they were doing so on behalf of the US Treasury. This is the checking on rates is very usual. The saying it's for the US Treasury, highly unusual. And this was a type of verbal intervention back in January. This time, it seems to me that the US has not commented on the BOJ's intervention. And I think that says something. I think the US is disappointed that the BOJ did not lift interest rates. That's been one of the sources of criticisms from the US Treasury Department of Japanese policy, both the exchange rate policy and interest rate policy. So I think that the Fed's silence or the US government's silence is telling. I suspect that they sort of would agree with me that the conditions weren't appropriate to intervene, especially in light of the BOJ's decision not to raise interest rates.
Okay, Mark, can you summarize all this for us, where we stand then? It seems like all the central banks very much on hold, but looking towards hiking rates. Data is mixed, earnings are strong, markets are extremely strong, and the leaders from last year being metals, some are still doing well, but they've lost that baton that they were carrying. So where do we stand? We're 4 months through this year, and everyone seems still pretty confused.
Yeah, I think you raise a good point. I think that, and I think this is really where the central banks come in too. Neither the duration nor extent of the war in Iran is really known. The fog of war continues to cast a pall over the investment climate. And what does this mean? I think that in the coming days, we've still got the May Day holidays. The UK's on holiday on Monday. Japan's on holiday now until Thursday next week. The Chinese markets are closed until Wednesday. We don't really have full liquidity. You've got a lot of these unknowns. And I think what this is conducive for is broad sideways trading. We saw the dollar index break down today below 98. It looked like it was about to test the April low, which was around 97.65 or so in the dollar index. We got down to almost 92.70, excuse me, 97.70. We're bouncing up here, and I think what we put in today was the lower end of the dollar index's trading range. The upper end, I think, is around 90, excuse me, around 99. So I would look for some broad consolidation in the near term. But like I say, I mean, the Federal Reserve is the only major central bank that the market still has some leaning towards a cut. And in any event, I mean, what are we really talking about? The Fed to be neutral when other central banks are, we're looking at the other central banks raising rates at least once. Some central banks, like the ECB, the market's pricing in three hikes for. So I think that given the geopolitical climate, given the mood about the trust in the US and all those related issues, coupled with monetary policy, I still would put myself in a dollar bearish camp for later this year. We need to, we've got the short run, maybe some dollar strength. Longer term, I'm still looking for a weaker dollar.
All right. Well, and I don't know. In a way, maybe we just expect that these markets just keep melting up. Dips have been bought very quickly. They've been shallow. They've been short. And markets are at all-time highs. It's crazy to see. But again, earnings are supporting that. The price to earnings ratios are not out of whack by any means due to these higher earnings. So, a real different picture, it almost sounds like, looking at the economy compared to the markets and earnings. But this isn't the first time we've been saying that. Time to wrap it up here, though. But Mark, great chatting with you. Again, Mark Chandler is a managing partner at Bannockburn Global Forex, also editor of the Mark to Market website. Click that link in the show notes. And for everyone listening, thank you for tuning in to this weekend show. Be sure to visit our website, kereport.com. And you can find all our content on your podcast player and on YouTube. Just search The KE Report. Keep in touch with Chad and I. We love hearing from each and every one of you. And we'll be back with a full slate of commentary throughout the week. Everyone, thanks for tuning in. Have a great weekend.
The Cortland Economics Report is produced for A.B. Cortland & Associates, Opinions expressed on this program are intended solely for the entertainment of our listeners, do not constitute investment advice, and are not necessarily those of this network, radio station, or our sponsors. Find out more about this program and today's guests by visiting www.kereport.com. For Al Corlin, this is Colleen Robbins. Join us again next week for the Corlin Economics Report.